much more grown up. I fear that I must own up to the fact that I'm in doubt of what the modern cynics shout of. They say it's spring, this feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say, that gave the whole world this crazy, heavenly, hazy hue. I'm a lark on a wing, I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a seasonal thing. They say it's spring, those bells that I can hear ringing. It may be spring, but when the robin starts singing, you're what I'm clinging to. Though they say it's spring, it's you. If poets sing that when a heart's sympathetic, it's merely spring, then poets' plights are pathetic, though I'm poetic too. They say it's spring, for lovers there's where the lure is, that evil thing, for which September the cure is. This they are sure is true, though I know so that my fancy may turn in the spring. With the right one in sight, one can find a perpetual thing. Did I need spring to bring the ring that you bought me? Though it was spring, that wondrous day that you caught me, darling, I thought we knew that it wasn't spring, 'twas you.
Red light, stop. Green light, go. Every symbol has a meaning, even those symbols on the meat sold in your grocery store. I'm Sarah Beck, Consumer Meat Specialist, U.S. Department of Agriculture. The purple shield with the letters USDA and the word prime, choice, or good is your sign of quality. Quality that's been checked by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Prime means it's the top grade and usually the most expensive. Choice, the grade you'll see in most stores, is also very high in quality. If the meat has been graded for quality, you'll know that it has also passed a strict inspection for wholesomeness. You'll see the symbol for wholesomeness, a round purple inspection mark, on wholesale cuts of meat and packaged meat products. For more information on buying meat, write How to Buy Meat, Agriculture Radio, Washington, D.C., 20250.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. That's right. They can help save lives by simply washing their hands. Just 20 seconds of thorough hand washing after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside can help fight against the dastardly spread of germs. Armed with only soap and water and hands, your superhero can protect you, your family, and everyone out there in America land. Amazing. Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary with you until 9 o'clock tonight. I don't know what's coming up next. I don't know if some version of On the Town is back on the air yet or not. I do know that Time Travel with Chris Earle should be back on from 5 to 7 every Wednesday. So your old Wednesday pattern, if you had an old Wednesday pattern, if you were a fan of Wednesday WMFO, Wednesday WMFO is coming back, and we are going to keep doing this until somebody comes along and says, no, you can't do that anymore. So you can look forward to the Big Picture being back with you every week. I'm working on getting Shea Spillane back involved in this, figuring out how to hook everything up so that she and I can talk and capture the audio and have it sound good. We'll see what happens with that. We should be a step closer to that next week. For now, there is the big question, the million-dollar question, the oh my God, make the cabin fever end question, when are we reopening? That's the one thing everybody wants to know. When do we go back to normal? Well, the first thing you need to understand is we don't go back to normal. As I said in late February, the world that you knew is gone. That world is over. And that world is not coming back until we either get a vaccine that is 100% effective against this virus, get a treatment, preferably a pill, that is 100% effective against this virus, or the virus goes away or mutates into something far less lethal than it currently is. None of those scenarios are likely in the near term. And by the time we get to one of those scenarios, we need to face the reality that some of the things you love, some of the things that you enjoyed, will belong to history because we won't need them anymore. That's a difficult and sobering thought for a lot of people, I know. And there are a couple of components to it, and we're going to talk about both components of that. But the first component of it that we need to address is, when the heck are we reopening? When can I go out and feel safe again? Well, if you're part of a vulnerable population, it's going to be a very, very long time before you can go out and feel safe again. I'll tell you that right now. You're going to have to continue to avoid people, even as we social distance, even as we reopen. People who are at a severe risk of dying from this illness are going to have to stay inside. They're going to have to stay away from people. There may be some accommodations made where they say, you know, similar to the special hours that we have at the supermarket, where they say you can come in on this day or you can come in at this point in time, but you're still going to have to take that risk. Now, I think most people sooner or later are going to want to take that risk. But we do have to understand that we live in a world now where the vulnerable are going to have less freedom, less opportunity to do things than people who don't have vulnerabilities for this disease. That's one thing that's changed and will stay changed until we have zero cases of COVID-19. So when are we reopening? Well, it depends. It depends on our political leaders. And our political leaders leave some room to be desired. I'm not going to name names here, okay? Because it doesn't do any good to say, this person screwed up and that person screwed up. This person did a good job. I trust where that person's going. Listen, I love Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Birx as much as anybody else. I'll listen to them all day long because they're not political. For anyone who's a politician involved in this, yeah, you probably screwed up a lot. And I'm probably fed up with you. There are a few exceptions, but there are very few exceptions. And the reason for this is because being a politician, being an elected leader, doesn't somehow remove you from human emotion, okay? It doesn't make you a smarter or more rational or better equipped or better prepared person. Everybody falls into a certain spectrum with what's happening right now. And that spectrum is governed by fear. So the question of when are we reopening is actually a question of when can we get over our fear? Here's some numbers for you. Because a lot of people are afraid of this disease. In surveys going back a few weeks, the numbers generally show about 80% of people who identify as liberal and 66% of people who identify as conservative are afraid of this disease. the people who are protesting to get their businesses reopened and let's go out again, they are the 34% of conservatives who are more concerned about economic ruin than they are catching COVID-19. They're partly wrong and they're partly right. The people who are terrified are partly wrong and partly right. There are some people, including some elected leaders, who are so scared that no amount of precaution or reassurance from doctors and health officials will convince them it is safe to reopen anything. Curiously, even though our media keeps talking about the protesters, right? We've seen those stories on the air over and over again. Oh, look at the idiots protesting to get their businesses reopened so they don't starve to death, so they don't go into bankruptcy. Look at those idiots protesting because they think they live in a free country. Look at those idiots. You know what we don't hear about? We don't hear about the people on the left who are so terrified of this disease that they don't want a reopening under any circumstance. And those people exist. Don't think for a second they don't. Don't think for a second they are not mayors or governors or Congress members. Those people exist. And the media is not telling you about them because the media, generally speaking, is more closely aligned with them. 30, 30, 40. If you know this show, you know that number. 30% of the country, liberal. 30% of the country, conservative. 40% in the middle. Where are we with COVID-19? Well, I gave you the numbers, right? We got about 30% of people. 30% of conservatives say, hey, let's reopen everything. And about 20% of liberals, by the way. So about 30% of the country says, hey, let's reopen everything. 30% of the country says, don't ever reopen anything under any circumstances whatsoever because we're all going to die and I'm afraid of the virus. And 40% is somewhere in the middle. So in order to reopen, we have to overcome the fear. And the fear is the problem. And the fear is very particular to our current situation because people don't necessarily understand what it is we're doing. They understand that we're all home. They understand everything's closed. They don't know why. And it has everything to do with how you would respond to a pandemic as a scientist, as a doctor, as an epidemiologist. I read a story earlier today talking about Vietnam. Vietnam has 90 million people, has not had a single coronavirus death. Now, you might say they're lying about it. They could be. I won't deny that possibility. But they haven't had many cases either. You've certainly heard about South Korea. South Korea stayed open through this whole thing. South Korea didn't shut down in total. And in both of those countries, they did the same thing. Testing. But not just testing. Testing and quarantine. They used an epidemiological strategy known as containment. What is containment? Containment says somebody has a virus. We're going to quarantine them. We're going to find everyone that they've been in contact with, known as contact tracing. We're going to quarantine all of those people. In Vietnam, they took it a step further. For every infected person, not only did they quarantine everyone that person had been in contact with, they quarantined everyone those people had been in contact with. Vietnam had tens of thousands of people quarantined, not at home, but on military bases, where they could keep an eye on them. And this does two things for you. Number one, it stops community spread, because you know where everyone is, and you know they're not going anywhere. But number two, because you're watching these people closely, at the first sign of severe symptoms, when it seems that interventions do the most good, you can get in there and do something. Vietnam figured out a solution, but Vietnam was only able to arrive at that solution because they had testing. The United States did not have testing. The United States should have had testing, but the CDC botched it. Big time. And there is no accounting for that. Okay, there is no getting around that. The CDC dropped the ball. Washington failed us with this virus. And because we weren't able to use containment, which is a strategy that worked in South Korea, it's the strategy that worked in Vietnam, it's the strategy that worked in New Zealand, it's a strategy that worked in Iceland. Because we weren't able to do that, we had to do something different. We had to use a strategy known as mitigation. And that's what our current social distancing is. That's what this is all about. That's what shutting down non-essential businesses and telling everybody to stay home is all about. It is an admission by epidemiologists and our politicians that the virus is out of control. It is an admission that the virus is loose in our communities. We don't know where it is, and we don't know how to stop it. All we can do is send everybody home and hope that by keeping distance, we can cut down on the number of infections. And that's worked. When they talk about flattening the curve, that's mitigation. That's what we're doing. If we manage to flatten the curve enough, if we manage to start reversing the trend and getting the number of new cases and the amount of spread back under control, then with robust testing and contact tracing, containment again becomes an option. That is the strategy. That is what the White House is looking at. That is what Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, and Governor Cuomo and Governor Baker and everyone else are talking about. We are talking about reopening with a containment strategy that uses testing and robust contact tracing to figure out, does someone have the virus? Who have they been around? How do we get all of those people quarantined? And you may have heard they're talking about phases for reopening. And all of these phases for reopening are all about taking a lot of steps to make sure that the virus will not start to spread again. The protests are a bad idea. And the protests are a bad idea because there are no steps being taken to mitigate the spread. We see a bunch of people showing up and screaming and yelling and being close to each other and talking to each other. That is the wrong way right now. And by the way, one of the preconditions for a phase one, because this is broken into phases, three phases, 2 weeks for each one. Phase one is you reopen some things. It's happening right now in Vermont. You can have two people in an office. You can have five people on a work site or five people in a manufacturing facility. They have to be at least 6 feet away from each other. There is still social distancing. Georgia, everybody's giving Georgia. They're going to reopen bowling alleys. Who cares? People like bowling. Bowling is a livelihood for the owners of bowling alleys and the employees of bowling alleys. You get social distance bowling. Use every other alley. What do you? You're angry because you can't go bowling. That's why you're upset about this. If that is a business that can operate safely, then it should be open. But in order for that business to be open, they have to test their people every single day. They have to have a bunch of protocols in place to make sure that they are not spreading the virus within their establishment. And some businesses in Georgia have been unable to open because they can't meet the criteria to reopen. So phase one, which is going to last for 2 weeks in every place that's doing it, we're going to open things up a little bit in the safest possible way. If we see more cases, if we see a surge, if we see cases rising again, we go back to where we are now. We go back to mitigation until we get down to a small number of cases, and then we're going to try phase one again. Phase one is actually a hybrid of mitigation and containment. It is mitigation in the sense that nobody from outside the community can come in to spread the virus, or no one from outside the region can come in to spread the virus. But people can move around within the town or within the region. And if any new cases show up, they're going to use contact tracing to try and isolate people. So it doesn't mean there is zero risk of you getting the virus. But it does mean that there is a much lower risk of getting the virus in a phase one scenario than there is in walking into the supermarket or a drugstore right now. Because we are still in, mitigation. So phase one is a combination of mitigation and containment. And as we move from phase one to phase three, we are moving fully from a mitigation strategy to control this outbreak to a hybrid to a pure containment strategy. The idea being that if new cases show up, we're going to be able to know who they are, we're going to be able to isolate those people, and we're going to be able to stop the spread. That means some people are still going to get sick. And that means, as individuals, particularly those people who are scared silly of getting this thing, those people who think no amount of protection is good enough, that everything should stay closed until we have a vaccine, which is not going to happen, because that is unrealistic. That would bankrupt everybody. That would put us back into the Stone Age if we did that. People who are that scared of the virus are going to have to figure out a way of living with this. You're going to have to learn to live with this risk, at least for a period of time. Or you're going to have to continue to hide. And you're going to have to face the consequences of that. The social loss, potentially the employment loss, the monetary loss, all of it. We are not going to go back into a situation where this virus doesn't exist, where it's perfectly safe. New Zealand might do that. New Zealand might achieve that, where when you're walking around on that island, you're totally safe. Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, maybe you can do that. But the only way that you're going to do that is anybody that comes onto one of those islands has to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Until you know that they don't have symptoms. And then you can let them out in public. I don't think that's going to be the procedure moving forward. But there is a plan. And there is a plan based on solid epidemiological science to take us from where we are right now, where we have no control at all over the spread of this virus, to a place where we do have control over it, where we can mitigate and manage the risk to individuals as much as is humanly possible, which will allow us to reopen certain businesses, which will allow us to go places again. But understand that when it comes to this question of reopening, it's going to take time. We're at least 6 weeks away from anything that would vaguely resemble a full reopening. And there will still be social distancing involved in that. And that timeline is going to depend on a couple of things. It's going to depend on whether or not people social distance now so that we get the decrease in cases that we need to move into phase one. So if you're out protesting, congratulations, you're making this longer for the rest of us. If you're out hanging out with your friends, going to underground nightclubs, going to parties, congratulations, you're making this longer for the rest of us. If you're out running around without a mask, congratulations, you're making this longer for the rest of us. We need the cases to go down. Generally speaking, the number that we're looking at is less than a 4% increase day over day. When the number of new cases grows by 4% or less for 2 weeks, and usually once you hit that 4%, it starts to decline rapidly. It goes from 4% to 3% to 1%, boom, no new cases. Once you hit that point, then you can start talking about reopening things. But we're going to need to overcome that fear that some have, including our politicians, including people in the media. We're going to need to get over that fear if we ever want to reopen at all. And believe me, we shouldn't have to drag anyone kicking and screaming into the next phase of our lives under this virus. The virus is here. The virus is not going anywhere. It is not going to magically disappear. You are never going to be 100% safe from it until we find either 100% effective treatment or 100% effective vaccine, and we don't know when those things are going to happen. Until we get there, we're going to have to take some measured risk. And the people who are most afraid are going to have to make their peace with it.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Would you please lower your aerial when entering Universal Studios Car Wash?
Car Wash. A typical day in L.A. Car Wash, yeah. Mr. Richard Pryor is Daddy Rich.
Praise the Lord! Praise the Lord! Why don't you climb on board and believe in me? Because it's better to have money and not to need it than to need it not to have it.
Well, praise this car, honey.
Thank you, miss.
Franco Najai, Professor Irwin Corey, and George Carlin as the cabbie.
We will go anywhere. We are not yellow. Now, get it? It's no kind of a slur in the Chinese or anything like that.
Special guest, the Pointer Sisters, and a full disco soundtrack. From Universal Pictures, it's a clean movie.
Rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
So before we go any further on this, there's a lot of heavy stuff that we've been talking about, and it's the news. It's where we are. The world has changed, and we all know that the world has changed. And we all know that we're stuck inside. And if you're in Massachusetts, you know we're going to be stuck inside probably for another month. Cabin fever, right? If you grew up around here, particularly if you grew up in northern New England, you know about cabin fever. We're equipped a little bit better to deal with cabin fever in the northern states, because it's a thing that happens. Winter rolls around, you can't go out because there's snow everywhere, right? It's less of an issue if you live in one of the urban areas. But even if you grew up around Boston, if you were a kid in the late 70s, you probably remember being stuck at home for most of the month of February during the blizzard of 1978. Cabin fever is a real thing. Everybody goes a little bit crazy because we're stuck inside. And talking to people, social media, all the rest of that, it helps somewhat. But at the end of the day, you're still stuck inside and you still want to go outside and you still can't go outside. And it seems like you're never going to escape this prison. This is not a prison. It's your home. It's a place that you love. But you've been inside those walls for so long that you just can't take it anymore. Well, I've got something that may help you. When you're dealing with cabin fever, you've got to be positive. You've got to think of the time, the day, whenever, you're going to be able to get out. And there are things that you can do while you're at home. There are simple thought exercises that you can do to help you cope with cabin fever. And I'm going to share 3 things that work for me. This may or may not work for you, okay? But these are things that work for me. And hopefully you will find this valuable. Hopefully you'll be able to incorporate this be a little bit less wound up, a little more hopeful for the future, because we need that right now. So the first thing I want you to do, these are 3 ways that are going to help you deal with the stress of everything that's going on and the stress of cabin fever. The first thing I want you to do is I want you to think of a place that you loved that's gone. Place that you loved that doesn't exist anymore. It should be a place that you have fond memories of. A place where you were happy. A place that you liked to go to. Maybe it's the old Orange Dinosaur miniature golf course on Route 1. That's gone. Maybe it's one of the old General Cinema's 2-screen movie theaters that used to be all over Massachusetts. Maybe it's Ruggles Pizza. Maybe it's the Bow and Arrow Pub. Maybe it's the Tasty in Harvard Square. There is a place that you used to love to go to, either when you were a kid or a young adult or whatever, that doesn't exist anymore. I want you to think about that place. I want you to think about what it meant to you. I want you to put yourself in there. I want you to picture yourself in there. Looking around, eating the food, or enjoying miniature golf or bowling, whatever, playing arcade games, whatever it was you did there. I guarantee that you have vivid memories of that space. And if you sit and think about it, you don't just see it, you smell it, you taste it, you feel it. You're there. You can place yourself right in that space. So I want you to think about that place. I want you to deeply think about it and really put yourself in there. Think about what it meant to you to be there. Think about how happy you were when you were there. Then I want you to think about how you felt when you found out it was closing. Because chances are, in a lot of cases with places like this, you've moved on. You know, it's a place that had meaning to you at one point in your life, but now you're somewhere else in your life. It's actually kind of rare for a place that we go to all the time, and a place that we really love, to just sort of shut down and close. Happened in Harvard Square 20 years ago. We all know that. But that's still kind of a rare thing. The Route 1 miniature golf course, that sort of came out of nowhere. Hilltop Steakhouse, another one that sort of, economic reality, sort of came out of nowhere. Think about how you felt when it closed. Think about how you felt the day that it closed. Did you make an effort to go there one more time to recapture those old feelings and those old memories? Think about it today. Think about it as it relates to your life right now. The memories of that place and the people you shared it with. And what you will find is that as time has gone by, the sadness of losing that place has started to fade. But chances are you're probably, hopefully, if you're lucky, still in touch with some of the people that made that place special to you. Whether it's your parents, whether it's your old roommates, whether it's your high school sweetheart who you married, whoever it is. Think about those people. And then do two things. First thing I want you to do is go on YouTube and find a video about that place. No matter what it is, there's a video about it. And if you don't believe me, start searching. Look up the name of the place. And I guarantee you, you will find video. It may be grainy old home video from the early days of home video. It may be Super 8 film. But just about any place that you can think of, there is some video somewhere of that place. Maybe it's old news coverage. Maybe it's old commercials. Whatever it is, you will find video of it on YouTube. So why don't you go on YouTube and find that? Then the next thing I want you to do is to share that video on social media with the people you associate with that place. Send them the video. Tell them that you were thinking about this. Tell them about a memory that you had with them at that place. Talk about it. Remember. That's the first thing I want you to do to help you to deal with your cabin fever. The second thing I want you to do is I want you to think about a place that is meaningful to you right now. Think about a place that you love to go to. It could be a vacation resort. It could be a movie theater. It could be a local bar. Think about a place that is meaningful to you now. Hampton Beach, Canobie Lake Park. Some place where you go with friends or by yourself or whatever, and like to be. Go online and find videos about it and watch those videos. Because again, no matter where it is, if it is an establishment, if it is a business of any kind, there is video of it. This is YouTube. There is video of everything. But I want you to do more than just watch the videos. I want you to go to the websites of those businesses. See when they're opening. See what they're saying. See what they're doing. Just check in. Check in with them on social media. See what they're saying. See what they're doing. The final thing I want you to do is to figure out what it is that you like about those places. Is it an amusement park? Do you like roller coasters? Is it an arcade? Do you like coin pushers? Do you like playing video games? Is it a bowling alley, because you love bowling? Is it a pool hall, because you love pool? Is it a movie theater because you love movies? Go online and research those things. Let that place that you like be your jumping off point to learning more about something that you love to do or a place that you love to go. Do some online research about it. See what other people are saying. And here's something I will tell you. No matter what the subject is, you will find people online, you'll find people on YouTube who are positive and friendly and enthusiastic and more than happy to share their passion with others and who will encourage and bring out your own passion. If you do this, what's going to happen is you're going to start thinking about the next time that you can go to that place. And when that opportunity comes, and it will be sooner rather than later, you'll be able to approach it with a new appreciation, not just for what that place is. Maybe you'll learn some secrets about it. Like one thing I didn't know is that there is a street light from the New York World's Fair at Canobie Lake Park near the entrance. There used to be a bunch of them. It's the one that's got the square shades on it that are all different colors. That's from the New York World's Fair. There's an actual piece of the New York World's Fair sitting up there in Salem, New Hampshire. That's cool. And that's something I didn't know. And that's something that I'll go look for the next time I go up there to ride Untamed and ride the Yankee Cannonball. Doing this is a way to keep yourself connected to the places that you love and the things that you love and to learn more about them and to learn more about yourself. Because as long as we're sitting around here, stuck at home, waiting for everything to reopen, there really isn't much else we can do. You could binge watch stuff on Netflix, or you could play some Animal Crossing. But believe me when I say, if you start digging into what it is that you love about these places, you'll find that you appreciate them that much more. Learn about their history, learn about their people, learn about the things that you do when you go there. You'll find an entire world of knowledge and enthusiastic people ready to guide you and help you. And it will help you keep that cabin fever at bay, because the truth about cabin fever is it's the monotony and the routine and the sameness of it. It's the fact that we're not learning new things. It's the fact that we're not engaging with the outside world that makes us go crazy. So follow those three tips that I gave you. Cabin fever may not disappear entirely, but it'll be a lot easier to handle. Back with more here on WMFO Medford.
Okay, gang. So chances are there'll never be an emergency ever, ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But just in case, let's talk about a plan.
Okay.
So who's going to do what? Anyone? Yeah, okay, perfect. We'll figure it out as we go. So, who is going to grab the go bag?
What's a go bag?
It is a bag we do not have that is filled with things we really, really need in an emergency.
Guess we won't have to worry about it then.
Ah, good point. So, we all know who to call if something happens then, right?
I'd have to call Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
And I will try to call all of you, but Greg doesn't have a cell phone. Dad's phone will have a dead battery.
No doubt.
And Julie will be on the phone with Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
Well, this is great. I am so glad that we don't have a plan.
I know.
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency, who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Did you read the news?
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. This is a pre-recorded version of The Big Picture. We are not live. Do not call. Do send money. Do not call. But do send money. Do not call, because if you call, it's just going to ring and ring and ring, and then the voicemail will pick up and say, we're not here, but feel free to send money. We'll have an address where you can send money later on in the show, because I would like some money. So we're pre-recorded tonight, talking about all of the different things that are going on right now. And you may have heard this headline yesterday, or you may have read this headline yesterday from one of the alarmist news outlets, one of the alarmist media sources. I saw some of the national media running with this story, and it annoyed the heck out of me, because they pulled one sentence. They pulled six words out of a lengthy, full-page advertisement. And this was their headline: "The food supply is vulnerable." That sounds scary, doesn't it? We don't have enough to worry about right now. The food supply is vulnerable. Does this mean I'm not going to be able to get food? Are we now all going to starve to death because of coronavirus? That's what they want you to believe. That's why they give you that headline. That's why somebody writes this in the first place. And as I said, this line, "the food supply is vulnerable," it didn't come from a news source. It didn't come from a journalist. It didn't come from anybody with the slightest bit of impartiality. In fact, it came from John H. Tyson. You might recognize that name, Tyson. Tyson, where have I heard that name before? They make chicken nuggets. Tyson Foods. This is that John Tyson, chairman of the board of Tyson Foods, the protein company, which on Sunday took out a full-page ad in the New York Times that is basically nothing but words. It's basically a lot of writing. And it carries the headline, "A Delicate Balance, Feeding the Nation and Keeping Our Employees Healthy." I'm going to read you some of this. I'm not going to read you all of it, because, quite frankly, a lot of it is just nonsense. But I want you to understand where this headline came from. The food supply chain is vulnerable. That's the headline. The food supply chain is vulnerable. That didn't come from a government expert. That didn't come from the Department of Agriculture. That didn't come from an independent journalist researching the food supply chain. That came from the chairman of the board of a meat packing company. And you need to understand that, to understand this headline and what's really going on here, because what's happening here is not a good thing. What's happening here is a very dangerous thing. And it's a sort of thing that we, the people, who are doing our best to keep each other safe, doing our best to look after each other, really need to take a dim view of. This is the sort of thing that we need to condemn. This is the sort of thing that we need to shame. This is the sort of thing that we need to say is unacceptable in our current environment. Let me give you a little bit of what Mr. John H. Tyson has to say. Tyson Foods has, this is about halfway down the first column. There's two columns of text. You can find it online if you look up Tyson's statement. You want to read the whole thing. It's about halfway down. "Tyson Foods has a responsibility to feed our nation and the world." This is the cornerstone premise of this piece. This is John Tyson saying, hey, we're too big to fail. Tyson Foods has a responsibility to feed our nation and the world. No, you don't. No, you don't. You're a private corporation. You have the opportunity to feed the nation and the world, but you don't have a responsibility to do that. You're not endowed with some authority by the government that makes you the only meat supplier in the world. We don't even necessarily need meat. And yes, I know what you're thinking. I'm not saying we should all go. Look, I'm the last guy that's going to tell you to go vegan. I'm as hardcore a carnivore as you're going to find. I would live on nothing but meat given the opportunity. But at the same time, I'm not going to let some president of a meatpacking company tell me that they have a responsibility to feed the world or that we can't survive without their meat. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Somehow, humanity made it for thousands of years without Tyson Foods. I just want to put that out there. Something to think about. Tyson Foods has a responsibility to feed our nation and the world. No, you don't. The government bodies at the national, state, county, and city levels must unite in a comprehensive, thoughtful, and productive way to allow our team members to work in safety without fear, panic, or worry. This is probably the biggest deflection I have ever seen in my life. The root cause of this, the reason this piece is even being written in the first place, is because Tyson has been ordered to shut down plants where people are getting coronavirus. And the reason people are getting coronavirus in these plants is because they all stand on top of each other. If you've ever been shoulder to shoulder on a subway, that's what these meat plants look like. Only instead of there being a subway in the middle, you got two groups of people standing shoulder to shoulder on either side of a production line. That's what it is to work in the meatpacking industry. You are shoulder to shoulder with everyone. And these meat processing plants, it turns out, are an ideal environment for spreading coronavirus because there have been a number of outbreaks around the country that have forced these plants to shut down. And every time one of these plants is forced to shut down because they can't keep their workers safe, we hear the same thing. You're disrupting the food supply. You're endangering the food supply. America's food supply is in jeopardy. People won't have meat. I don't hear these problems coming from the soup industry. I don't hear these problems coming from the pasta industry or the breakfast cereal industry or the egg industry or the butter industry or any industry. This is a problem that seems to be particular to the meat packing industry. Smithfield, Tyson, ConAgra. Anybody who's involved in meatpacking. I don't know how much meatpacking ConAgra does. I'm sure they do some. So Tyson has a responsibility to feed the nation. I'm still on this one paragraph. But the government has a responsibility, apparently, to allow Tyson employees to work in safety without fear, panic, or worry. No. No, John Tyson. That is not how this works. Basically, what you're saying is that America can't survive without you, so the government needs to come in and find a way for your people to work safely. You are a private company. You are a capitalist. And as a capitalist, you should be ashamed of yourself for telling the government that they need to come in and save you. Captains don't go down with the ship anymore. We're past that era of chivalry and gentlemen in our world. No, captains don't go down with the ship. Captains now go to the public and say, hey, you're not going to have any Tyson nuggets if you don't put pressure on the government to reopen our plant. He goes on to say, the private and public sectors must come together. As a country, this is our time to show the world what we can do when working together. Public sector doesn't have any involvement here. You are a private enterprise. You are a private business. Tyson Foods is a publicly traded company. If you can't figure out how to operate your business in the middle of this pandemic, that's your problem. That is not the federal government's problem. You don't get a bailout, okay? You weren't undone by some government policy. You were undone by your own practices. It is unsafe to work in your plants. At least that is the theory. I don't know for certain that it's unsafe to work in those plants. But the health authorities that are shutting the plants down seem to think that's the case. John Tyson goes on to say, in addition to meat shortages, this is a serious food waste issue. Farmers across the nation simply will not have anywhere to sell their livestock to be processed when they could have fed the nation. Well, there is a grain of truth to that. But we need to understand why that is true. And the reason that is true is because the big food companies, Tyson, Smithfield, ConAgra, have spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying Congress to pass legislation and regulation that is favorable to these giant food producers and hazardous and anti-competitive to small business. Anyone who follows the agriculture space has been hearing about this for years. Packaging rules, labeling rules, all of these things disproportionately impact the small business. They impact the small distributor who cannot afford to absorb the costs of new machinery to keep up with regulations, cannot afford to change all of the packaging to keep up with regulations. Farmers are trapped. Farmers are trapped having to deal with these big meatpacking plants. And there are only a handful of them in the country, by the way. There are a handful of plants, and when they talk about it, oh, this plant supplies 4% of the nation's pork, or this plant supplies 5% of the nation's beef. How did we let that happen? How did we get to a point where one plant in one state supplies 5% of our food? Does that not seem like a bad idea to anyone other than someone using IBM Watson to maximize profit in their production? Because that's really what this is about. This is what Tyson and Smithfield and the other companies have done. They have created a factory industry that churns through people, that forces people to work long, difficult, hard hours, shoulder to shoulder, so they can maximize the amount of money that they make selling their products. And now that you're faced with a virus that easily spreads in close quarters, those production methods don't work. And because the legislation is set up so that they're the only ones who can actually package and sell meat, the farmers have no place to take their livestock. And we know this is happening. We have food banks all over the country begging for anything they can get. We have farmers in Idaho, I guess, they're just putting up huge piles of potatoes at the side of the farm and telling people, come on in, take all you want. Because they have no way of getting them to market legally. This is a society that we built. And this is a society that strongly benefits somebody like John Tyson, which is why he has the hubris to come out and say, Tyson Foods has a responsibility to feed our nation. No, you do not. No. You are a for-profit company. You have the opportunity to feed our nation and the world. You have the opportunity to make money on that, because you have stacked the entire system to favor you and a handful of competitors. He goes on. He says this again. Millions of animals, chickens, pigs, and cattle will be depopulated because of the closure of our processing facilities. The food supply chain is breaking. No, it's not. Huge segments of the food supply chain are just fine. The Tyson Foods and the Smithfield Farms section of the food supply is breaking because you built systems that don't work in a pandemic. You created this problem. And rather than find creative ways to address it, such as spacing out workers on your lines, maybe running the lines a little more slowly, maybe not churning out as much product per day, you are coming to the people via a full-page ad and saying, please tell the government to leave us alone. Please tell the government that you want chicken nuggets and Tyson beef products. Please tell the government to stop shutting us down. They're shutting down the food supply. You'll have nothing to eat. Not true. We won't have Tyson Foods. He actually says that at one point in here. Our plants must remain operational. Oh, here we go. We have a responsibility to feed our country. It is as essential as health care. If you're not laughing by this point, you really should be. Because this is where, I don't know if he had COVID-19 when he wrote this and maybe was having those hallucinations that Chris Cuomo talked about. Tyson Foods is nowhere near as essential as healthcare. Okay? You're not even in the wheelhouse. You're not even in the ballpark. That's just pure fantasy. That's hilarity ensues is what that is. This is a challenge that should not be ignored, Tyson says. Our plants must remain operational so that we can supply food to our families in America. This is a delicate balance because Tyson Foods places team member safety as our top priority. Well, okay. What did they do? In January, they formed a coronavirus task force. Okay, I'll buy that. Big companies mostly did that. Some did, some didn't. The ones that are really looking at risk management did. So, sure, you had a task force. What did the task force say? Did the task force say, hey, you know what? We can't have people working shoulder to shoulder because the virus will spread. Apparently, they didn't. The company's efforts have included taking worker temperatures and installing more than 150 infrared walkthrough temperature scanners in our facilities. That does nothing. Taking temperatures does nothing. Coronavirus spreads from asymptomatic people. You don't have a virus, or you don't have a fever, you don't have a cough, you don't have a headache, you don't have a sore throat, you don't have anything. But every time you breathe, the virus is coming out. It's called asymptomatic spread. And anyone who's telling you that thermometers are going to get us through this, and that taking people's temperatures is how you ensure safety, is delusional. Doctors know better. Epidemiologists know better. The disease spreads asymptomatically. Is it good to keep people with fevers out of the workplace? Yes. Okay? People with fevers should not be walking around. If you have a fever, you stay home. But that does not protect worker safety because it does nothing to stop asymptomatic spread. Now, if you'd come out, John Tyson, and said, we're giving daily antibody tests, or we're giving daily nasal swabs to everyone who works here, and we don't let them come to work until they have a clear bill of health, all right, I'd say that's a good idea. That's not what you're doing, okay? You put in some thermometers, and you said, hey, we're checking for fevers, and everybody's healthy. No, that is not enough. That is not a solution. We've implemented social distancing measures, such as installing workstation dividers. A workstation in a meat plant is about 2 feet of space in front of you, where the production line goes by. That's your workstation. So they hung sheets of plastic in between people who are still standing shoulder to shoulder. Do you think that piece of plastic is doing anything? The number of people who are getting infected, the fact that these meat plants are the new epicenters and the new hot zones of the coronavirus, tells everything you need to know. The piece of plastic that you put up in between the workstations does nothing. We provided more break room space. I don't know what Tyson did, but I read one story talking about I believe it was a Smithfield plant, where the modifications to the break room space, they came in and they took all the chairs away. That's what they did. And they said, hey, this is to stop the spread of coronavirus. We're taking all the chairs out of the break room. I'm sure the workers love that. That's a great way to keep people safe. And here's one of my favorites. We've also relaxed our attendance policy to encourage workers to stay at home when they're sick or feel uneasy about coming to work. Your policy always should have been that workers stay home when they're sick. You're a meat handler. Forget coronavirus. There's any number of foodborne illnesses that can come from sick workers in your plants. Now, I've only read from about 3 paragraphs in this thing, okay? But I think by now you get a point and a sense of how delusional this thing is. And you understand what's going on here. This is the chairman of the board of Tyson Foods saying, hey, we're too big to fail. We need the government to lay off. We need the government to tell us we have an exemption. We need the government to tell our people to go back to work, or there's not going to be any food anymore. And the problem with